supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. According to a report from the Institute of Medicine, nearly one-third of Americans struggle with chronic pain. I'm one of them. 3 years ago, following an accident that injured my spinal cord again, I was left with severe pain in both arms. I'm not alone. There are many, many of us who are living with severe pain. And the numbers of us, it's more than the number of patients with cancer, heart disease, and diabetes combined. And I'm guessing even that is an underestimate, because so many people who live with pain feel pain is shameful and they don't want to talk about it, or they minimize it, or they feel they have to be strong or stoic through pain. So my guess is it's much more than one-third of us. The costs are huge, financially and emotionally, physically. People who live with chronic pain tend to be more isolated because there's no voice for pain. There's no way to describe it. And many who live with chronic pain feel very alone in the world. So today on Voices in the Family, we're going to speak with experts about what we're learning, what the research is showing, and we're going to learn about new methods of dealing with chronic pain. Today we'll be talking with Drs. Jeffrey Mogul and Eric Garland. Dr. Mogul is head of the internationally known Pain Genetics Lab at McGill University and has made seminal contributions to the field of pain genetics and is the author of most major reviews on the subject and editor of the only textbook, The Genetics of Pain. I'm told we have difficulty with our phone connection with Dr. Mogul, but we will get to him later in the show. Eric Garland is an associate professor at the University of Utah College of Social Work and an associate director of integrative medicine and supportive oncology at the Huntsman Cancer Center. He has developed a method called MOR, Mindfulness-Oriented Recovery Enhancement. Eric Garland, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We have Mogul.
And I am guessing, I'm told we have Jeffrey Mogul. Dr. Mogul, welcome. Do we have you? Not quite yet. Okay. I want to give our listeners the number. I have a feeling, Eric, there's a lot of people who are listening to the show who want to call in. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Eric, tell us about why we have pain in the first place and its evolutionary nature. I mean, what does Darwinism say about pain?
You just gave me a slightly small topic to talk about. I'll do my best.
I'll give you 90 seconds then.
Okay. Well, we have pain because pain serves in a very important function, in the sense that it, from an evolutionary perspective, it alerts us to potential danger, and it motivates us to take action to keep ourselves safe. So, for example, if you injure your leg, and if continuing to walk on that leg would cause further damage to the leg, then the brain and body together produce the experience of pain, which provides a signal that tells the body, stop moving. And in the short term, this could be very advantageous, because if you continued to walk on the leg, it would cause damage to the leg.
Okay.
So acute pain is very functional in that respect.
Okay. So we need to have pain. It puts the whole body in crisis mode, yes?
Yes, crisis mode to serve an end of protection.
Sure.
But when acute pain becomes chronic pain, this function changes.
Well, that is a transition that really is the story of the show, how we transition, how the brain-body transitions from acute to chronic. Jeffy, I'm told we have you on the phone now. Are you there? Still having trouble with Jeffrey. He's around. We'll just flick some more buttons and we'll find him.
Sounds good.
I want to talk about other kinds of acute pain, because if there's a reason for acute pain and that it tells us what we need to do, then what about other kinds of pain, like, say, kidney stones, for example? I mean, it feels like a crisis, but, I mean, it's really not. There's nothing life-threatening. I also have a phenomenon when my bladder goes into spasm, my blood pressure goes sky high, and I can feel my body is in crisis. My body says, let's do something. And I know it's not an emergency, but I still feel the crisis. How do you explain that from an evolutionary perspective?
Well, that's a really good point. And I think one key issue, and this is going to come back up when we talk about mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement and the way it works to treat chronic pain, is that the body provides a whole range of sensations, and the sensations provide information, but the information may not be clear-cut. So you have a sensation in your body, for example, with a kidney stone, and that sensation you may interpret as painful. But really, the sensation is essentially just telling you that there's a process going on in your body. And so it's not necessarily a life-threatening process, but it's providing feedback or information about the state or the condition of the body. And we, our minds, determine, in a very large sense, the meaning of that sensation. So we decide, is that sensation telling us something bad is happening? Is this dangerous? Is this just a natural process of our body functioning?
Well, no, wait a minute.
And so the way the mind ascribes meaning to that sensation determines, to some extent, how we feel about that sensation and how distressing that sensation becomes to us.
All right, let's veer off a little bit here, because I want to get it at the big picture here. So, you know, we all watch these magnificent athletes engage in whatever sport they engage in, and even weekend warriors. So we hear the phrase, no pain, no gain. And,
yeah.
You know, we athletes perform in pain. So does that saying work for them to a certain extent? You do play with pain. You have to play with pain. And what about the rest of us?
Absolutely. That's a really good point. I mean, the bodies of these athletes are under tremendous stress, tremendous strain to the bones, to the musculature, to the cartilage, ligaments, etc. And they are pushing themselves through the pain. And this, again, goes to my last comment, which is, I think a high-level athlete learns to interpret the sensations from the body differently than perhaps the rest of us. So if any one of us was in that level of discomfort, we might consider it agonizing and we might give up. But I think the athlete learns to interpret those sensations differently, not as a danger to their health, but really as the sense of their body performing at a high level.
Well,
being able to reinterpret the sensations of the body in this way provides them some, I guess you could say, power over those sensations.
Well,
and again, Go ahead.
Even the weekend warriors, I mean, you know, you exercise and, you know, you're hurting. So
that's right.
So that's a good thing.
That's right. And that's one of the tricks, I think, to exercise is learning that sensation of discomfort doesn't mean that you're getting hurt, but rather, in most cases, it means that you're actually getting stronger. And so, again, it shows you the power that the mind and the brain has over the interpretations of the sensation of the body, which enables you to perform. And I think there's a secret there in terms of treatment of chronic pain conditions.
Well, what about, though, how do we know when the pain is, you know, an important pain that's telling us something? And
yeah.
How do we know when we just have to push through the pain?
Yeah, and that's a really good point and a very complex issue to solve. I mean, I think that's where we really need the assistance of physicians, for example, who can provide us with clear assessments about our health and let us know whether what we're doing is damaging or not.
Yeah, and then there's...
Because a lot of times it's really hard to tell as an individual.
Well, you know, you're talking about interpreting pain. How many of us also interpret what our physicians tell us?
Good point.
let's go to the phones. We got Monique on the line. Hey, Monique.
Hi.
Hey.
I live in Wilmington, Delaware, and I have been in wellness, and my background's in psychology, and I love your show.
Thank you.
And it's interesting because this is the direction I'm heading with the fitness and wellness that I deliver to my clients. I started learning a method that works with the connective tissue and the nervous system. And even before I started learning this method, it really has been sort of a light bulb flickering in the back of my mind until recently the light bulb finally turned on. That so many people don't have relationships with their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go to a doctor, we say, give me some medication for this issue or this symptom, or, you know, we go to a massage therapist when we're tense. But we don't necessarily look for signals that tell us before pain is going to come and that it's on its way if we don't do something.
I'm curious, your thoughts about this, Eric?
I agree with the caller's statement that people really vary to the extent that they are aware of what's happening in their bodies, and teaching people to become more aware of what's happening in their bodies is important for healthy functioning, and I think it's important for learning how to cope with pain and discriminating when an activity is dangerous versus not.
This is really a big issue, and Monique, I'm so glad you brought it up.
Well, and the no pain, no gain is really funny because just recently someone said it, and I've worked in teaching boot camps and more of the intense kinds of things where, you know, athletically you're working to a level where you have to really decide, is this helping me or hurting me? And you think about the Olympics just finished, a lot of those athletes know it's going to be over, so that's sort of what can mitigate it. But it's also, I like to say, no pain, no gain, you're not using your brain.
Well, I appreciate your perspective and your input. I think it's very valuable what you're bringing up, and I thank you for sharing it. Take good care, Eric. My experience is so many of my patients and I'm assuming friends really don't have a relationship with their bodies. You know, they push them relentlessly. They ignore pain and discomfort. And, you know, when I ask people how their bodies feel, you know, first they don't know even what I'm talking about. And then once they feel their bodies, it's just tremendous stress. You know, their bodies are exhausted.
Yes, absolutely. This is a very key issue in chronic pain as well as in a lot of other health and mental health disorders. There's a process called interoception, and interoception is the process by which the brain senses the physical condition of the body. And people really, people vary to the extent to which they can do this. They can have interoceptive awareness of the body. And it seems multiple conditions, including chronic pain, that interoception goes awry. So So the ability to sense the body becomes, it's either dampened or it becomes distorted. And this can lead to problems, obviously, that you're bringing up.
How does that chronic pain make it go awry?
Another very small subject. It's a good question and a complex process. And it's also somewhat of a chicken and egg issue in the sense that it may be that chronic pain sufferers, some of them may have difficulties with interoception before they even develop chronic pain. But certainly, as a person's pain transitions from acute to chronic, their ability to sense what's going on in the body can become compromised, and there are many ways this can happen. So one way, and this is a way that I focus on in my treatment, is when a person is hurting, they tend to be upset. But when they're upset, and that upset could be afraid, it could be angry, it could be sad, when they're upset, those negative emotions actually influence the way that we perceive the sensations in the body.
Well,
but they, in some ways, you could say they distort or magnify the discomfort in the body.
Well, we're going to take a short break right now, and I've just been given great news that we have Dr. Jeffrey Mogul online. We're going to talk with him about the DNA of pain and how our genetics play into our experience of it, and so much more. So, we are talking with Dr. Eric Garland. He's an associate professor at the University of Utah, and he's developed a method called mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement. The research on this is quite impressive. And like I said, when we come back, Dr. Mogul is well-known nationally and internationally around issues of the genetics of pain. Our number is 888-477-9499. We have a couple of lines open. Please call early. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm drunk or high. Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about chronic pain with Drs. Jeffrey Mogul and Eric Garland. Jeffrey Mogul, welcome to the show. Hi there.
Thank you. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if the problem was you or us, but I apologize to you and our listeners for that difficulty. So listen, I got a question about the brain. And the question is, when we transition from acute pain to chronic pain, it's like the brain doesn't make that transition so well.
Actually, I would argue it's the other way around, that it's the brain that is making the transition, and it's not a transition that's supposed to be made. Most people studying chronic pain assume that chronic pain is a pathology, that it's a disease in its own right, and that the disease is related to the fact that the tissue is already healed and there's no reason for the pain to be there. But somehow some change occurs in the brain so that the switch gets, you know, jammed in the on position. And even though the body isn't sending any signals anymore of any tissue damage, nonetheless, pain is being perceived. And, of course, this is almost certainly happening in the brain and or in the spinal cord.
So the brain gets it.
Well, again, there's no it to get. That's the point, is that in chronic pain, the idea is there's no tissue damage anymore. It's healed.
Right.
It's gone. But nonetheless, the perception is still one of pain as if there were ongoing tissue damage. And usually this is ascribed to a nerve damage. So either a peripheral nerve or some circuit in the brain is damaged. And that's what's given rise to this. And so, again, the transition is ultimately whatever happens in the nervous system that is making you perceive pain, telling you there's tissue damage, when in fact there is no more tissue damage.
What's causing the pain in chronic pain?
But that's exactly it, and we don't know. I mean, that's the million-dollar question, is that just exactly what is the pathology, what is the change in the nervous system that has happened, and why that change happens in some people and not in others. And that, of course, is the critical point. 100 people can get in the same car accident and have the same injury to a peripheral nerve, and only about 6 or 8 or 12 at the most, are going to develop chronic pain. Everyone else is going to heal up just fine and have no pain at all.
All right, so you just screwed me up here. I had a whole nice interview, and your answer to this question raises about 37 others.
So I'm sorry to do that to you.
I've got to tell my producer, Gita, we're not going to stop at the end of an hour. We got to go at least till 3:30 here today. Oive. So, which is ancient Greek for oive.
I speak that form of ancient Greek.
Good. So here I am, for example. I don't know if you heard the opening of the show. So
yeah, I heard most of it.
Okay, so I'm experiencing chronic pain. On a bad day, on a good day, I feel like I've got a severe sunburn. On a bad day, I feel like I've got no skin there. Now, we don't know what's actually causing the pain, because my neurologist said the nerves there are just hyperstimulated.
Yeah. Yeah, the nerves are hyperstimulated. What you have almost certainly is a phenomenon known as sensitization, and it's probably in the brain or spinal cord, so it's probably central sensitization.
Right.
But the question is why? What caused central sensitization in you? So, why did that happen?
So where we are, I can talk about the trauma that...
But people with equivalent trauma don't necessarily develop chronic pain.
That's really fascinating. That's really fascinating to me. So all we can do now is treat it symptomatically.
At the moment, yes. Now, of course, people are working very, very hard to try to understand what the pathology is and what these transitional steps are on the cellular and molecular level. And, of course, we've made some progress there. We have any number of ideas. And any number of molecules we know are involved, and any number of genes we know are involved. The problem is, in some sense, we know too much. We know too many molecules. We know too many genes. And the story gets very, very complicated. It's been completely impossible to put it together. But, of course, the good news is that the more molecules we learn are involved, the more we can potentially target them as new, possible therapies.
And of course, therapies go both ways, because what we're learning now over the last decade is that psychotherapies change physiology.
Yeah, of course they do. Right.
Yeah, we didn't know that a decade or two ago. Eric, tell us about more.
Sure. And this clearly pertains to what Dr. Mogul had just brought up, the issue of central sensitization. But then, of course, we have a higher brain, we have a higher cortex, which assesses the condition of the nervous system, and that is really the pathway through which psychological therapies can improve chronic pain symptoms. So I designed mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement to target some of the cognitive and the emotional aspects of chronic pain to improve the quality of patients' lives. So mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement is a mental training program that unites complementary aspects of mindfulness training, cognitive behavioral therapy, and principles from positive psychology into an integrative treatment strategy. And I developed this treatment by after reading some of the neuroscience literature and some of the cognitive science literature about chronic pain and its consequences and causes.
So what's it look like?
Really, it integrates three separate strategies into one treatment approach. So the first strategy is attentional control. And that is, and more, we teach patients to enhance their attentional control so that they can learn how to focus on and also to disengage from the sensations of pain in their body so they don't become so fixated on them.
Wait, that sounds contradictory.
That's right. It does sound contradictory, but it's actually a multi-stage process. So in terms of actually dealing with the pain sensation itself, we teach patients to focus their attention on the part of the body that is hurting and to break down that experience of pain into its components. What I mean by that is to, instead of thinking, I have this awful agony in my back, mm-hmm. we teach patients to focus on the precise sensory quality of that experience. So instead of thinking, I have this awful agony in my back, we teach them to focus on that experience as a sensation of tightness in the muscles
and
a sensation of warmth or heat.
As opposed to focusing on the storyline that goes with it.
Exactly. As opposed to focusing on the emotional storyline and instead of taking this emotional view of pain, actually just focusing on the sensory components. And interestingly, the data shows that the more people are able to do this, the greater pain relief they achieve.
Sure, which is very, very counterintuitive.
It is.
But
we normally think we need to distract ourselves from pain. But actually, this comes back to the issue I was talking about before, interoception, or the ability to sense the condition of the body. By teaching people to increase their interoceptive awareness, to actually get in touch with what's happening in the body, it may be that people are tapping into what Dr. Mogul was talking about when he was saying that in chronic pain, the physical pathology is gone. There is no major damage left in the body under many circumstances. And so it could be that the person is learning to sort of undo their storyline, as you say, about the pain, and actually get a better sense of what's going on, and in so doing, realize that maybe it's not as bad as they thought it was. Maybe they can cope with it better.
What you are asking and what I ask my patients to do is to develop a real honest curiosity about their body so they can become researchers. And when my patients tell me they experience pain, even in my office, I get very curious about it. But where is it? Does it have a texture or a temperature? And how far does the periphery go? And where's the central part? And,
exactly.
You know, and I get curious and they get curious. And if we can, you know, carry ourselves just mindful of what we're experiencing in our body without a storyline, that would be great. But that's easier said than done.
Yes, it is. It takes a lot of practice, and that's why I call more a mental training program, because through training, through practice, we can learn to change the function of our minds and thereby change the function of our brains and possibly change the structure of our brains through neuroplasticity, which of course is ultimately a result of gene-by-environment interactions.
Yeah, I want to hear about that. Let's go to the worldwide expert on that. Jeffrey, we used to think that our DNA was what it was, you know, that we're born with it. It doesn't change. And the assumption was that we can't influence it.
Well, strictly speaking, that's actually still true. What we now know, and actually we've known this for a long time, it's got a fancy new name now, but what we now know is that the expression of genes can be altered by environmental events, and of course we've known that for a long time. But now we have some insight into the molecular mechanisms by which that happens, and so it's given rise to a field called epigenetics. And so, yes, through epigenetic modifications, we can have genes express at higher levels and at lower levels. But your DNA sequence, the variants of whatever genes turn out to matter for pain, that's actually quite fixed from the moment you're conceived.
But what gets expressed and what doesn't makes, I mean, those
well,
are
exactly,
those
right?
are life I mean, and death issues, literally.
Yes, of course. I mean, your DNA sequence simply determines your genes, but of course, what's performing all the work of biology aren't your genes, but your proteins that the genes make. And how much those proteins are expressed, so how many are there in what place and in what function, obviously is modifiable.
Which is what we might ultimately, I'm off on a bit of a tangent here, what we might ultimately discover about the autism spectrum. It's about amounts of protein on these genes that do or don't get expressed and to what extent they get expressed.
Yes, exactly. In fact, most complex diseases turn out to be a matter of the combined involvement of many, many genes. And when I say many, I mean hundreds or thousands. And what is being inherited there isn't the form of those genes, but rather the amount of protein that gets expressed. Just a tiny bit more, just a tiny bit less.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones. We've got Hugh on the line now. Hi, Hugh.
Hello. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and my mother, back in the late 80s, was at McGill. And she actually did research working with patients with rheumatoid arthritis in a group setting using somatic psychotherapy and got some pretty positive results. My question is, there's this confluence of emotional pain and physical pain in these chronic patients, and I'm wondering to what degree they interact and to what degree possibly the inflammatory process is driving both of those elements.
I think that's a great question. As a matter of fact, I was going to get there myself. And following up, both gentlemen, is the relationship between depression and anxiety and pain and even despair. Eric, let's toss it to you first.
Sure, and I'll handle the overlap of emotional and physical pain in the brain and then maybe pass off the inflammatory question. But yes, there's a lot of research to suggest that the same neural circuits in the brain that are involved in processing negative emotions involve the same brain areas that are involved in processing pain. So some of those key structures include the anterior cingulate cortex and the insular cortex. And so it's very well possible that the brain has difficulty discriminating between emotional and physical pain, because in a large sense, in both of these processes, the brain is simply sensing the physical condition of the body, and the physical condition of the body is altered by the experience of pain as well as by the experience of negative emotion.
So what you're suggesting, and I believe I read this many years ago, what you're suggesting is pain, and the same parts of the brain get activated.
Right. Emotional pain, physical pain. I mean, there are differences, so I'm not saying
sure.
They're one and the same, but there is a large overlap in the brain, and therefore negative emotions can amplify physical pain. And we also know, of course, the opposite, that when we're in pain, this triggers negative emotions. So it can become a vicious cycle, a feedback loop. And the only thing I'll state about inflammation, and I can't say that I'm an expert here, is simply that parts of the brain that control the autonomic nervous system and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, these parts of the brain are activated during stress and negative emotion, which can influence stress hormones, and which also in turn influence inflammatory processes in the body. So it is possible that if a person is in a heightened negative emotional state, they're upset, whether it's because of their pain or they're upset because of other life stressors, you know, challenges at work, challenges in their family, what have you, that this negative emotional state could increase the inflammatory processes in the body and therefore potentially enhance and intensify the pain process.
So, Jeffrey, I'm going to follow up in a bit of a different direction. We're talking about the parallels between physical and emotional pain, and I was going to bring up the issue of a phantom pain and an amputee, and they still feel the pain where that limb used to be. And in my office, you know, I see grief in the same way. It's phantom pain. It hurts where that person used to be, or with trauma, it hurts where yesterday used to be, where my old life used to be. And they look the same, they sound similar, and they feel similar, I would think, in the body.
Yeah, I mean, I love the metaphor. I think we take such metaphors too literally at our peril. But you know, what Dr. Garland said about the overlap is true, although I wouldn't describe it as a lot of evidence. There's a little evidence, most of it coming out of one lab in Los Angeles, that shows that, yes, there's overlaps in the neuroanatomy between physical pain and emotional pain. There's actually one study that is really, really intriguing. And if I remember correctly, what they did was they had people remember about a breakup they just had with their boyfriend or girlfriend. And they had to rate how much emotional pain they were in while thinking about this very recent breakup. And half the people in the study were given aspirin, and half of them were given a placebo pill. And it turns out that aspirin was able to decrease self-reported emotional pain, which is, you know, pretty interesting.
Big Pharma never got a hold of that study, did they? Because they would have burned it immediately. We've got to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about pain and aging. So we're talking about chronic pain and different ways of understanding it, different ways of treating it, with Doctors Jeffrey Mogul and Eric Garland. Mogul's the head of the internationally renowned Pain Genetics Lab at McGill University. Eric Garland is an associate professor at the University of Utah, and he's developed a method called MOR, Mindfulness-Oriented Recovery Enhancement. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
The Children's Crisis Treatment Center supports WHYY. Did you know that 68% of Philadelphia residents have had an adverse childhood experience? From physical abuse to neglect to exposure to violence, these traumatic experiences during childhood can have a lifelong impact on a person's health and well-being. Philadelphia is at the forefront of healing and resilience. On March 20th at WHYY, experts will address Children and Toxic Stress, a public health response for Philadelphia. Information and to register at cctckids.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about chronic pain with Doctors Jeffrey Mogul and Eric Garland. I'm going to turn to you, Eric. Our brains, our lives, are really social phenomenon. Physician David Brio said in his book, The Language of Pain, he said, pain threatens to exile us from the world, end quote. And to me it makes sense, because there's really no way to describe to others the truly the experience of pain. All you can say is it feels like, but it never quite gets there. It does kind of break down the interpersonal bridge.
That's right. It does. Absolutely. And that, I think that's one of the most serious and hurtful consequences of pain, is the effects of pain on the ability to function in life, the ability to relate and connect with others, the ability to do work, to do meaningful activities, and enjoy life. And it's really a sad consequence of pain, and especially as pain becomes chronic.
Matt?
And the treatment that I developed really is focused on targeting this issue and teaching people how to essentially to get on with their lives in spite of the pain, to learn how to step back from the pain and to refocus their attention and refocus their self into their life so that they can enjoy themselves in spite of the adversity that they're facing.
I want to ask both of your question about, speaking of socially, what can mitigate pain. And I'll start with you, Jeffrey. Are you aware of any research about the impact of empathy and compassion on pain? I vaguely recall reading an article many years ago that men who had low back pain, when their wives were sympathetic and understanding, the pain actually got worse?
Yeah, exactly. That's a very famous study by Herta Flor. So yes, if you have a solicitous spouse, one that says, "Oh, you know, Harry, I'll get you some water, and let me take care of everything, and you just sit there, and I'll take care of you," this actually makes chronic pain levels higher. And spouses that say, "Oh, come on, you can do it yourself," this actually ends up making it better. This has also been shown in children, I believe. Christine Chambers at Dalhousie has shown that when parents tell their child that, "Oh, everything is going to be all right," this actually makes pain hurt more, not less. This empathy has also been studied in the laboratory, in humans, and also in animals. So we published a paper a number of years ago showing that even mice were capable of empathy for pain in terms of pain being contagious from one person to another, animal to another.
I have to find when my pain is severe, and, you know, I'm not particularly looking for anything. It's my pain. It's no big deal now. But, I mean, when I watch people, friends or my nurse, react with compassion or just respect for the pain, you know, they're more careful. It feels good. It makes me feel more connected, less alone with my pain.
I bet it does. But the big problem, of course, you know, you were talking about the impact on people's social life, and the horrible part is that it works in two ways, both which are bad. Chronic pain patients first have a tendency to want to withdraw from their social environment, which is bad. But the other thing that's even worse, in a sense, is that eventually no one wants to hear about it anymore.
Right.
Right? I mean, stemming from the fundamental problem of you can describe it, but you can't really make them understand, pain is utterly subjective. It's an utterly private thing. And eventually people just tune out. They just don't want to hear it anymore from the chronic pain patient, which, of course, isolates them even further. And so it's a real horrible thing.
Well, and it develops a secondary disease, which is even worse than chronic pain, and that's the disease of self-pity. Talk about something that can ruin your life.
It's something that needs to be said, is that one other terrible thing about chronic pain is that it's associated with a lot of other things that either come with the pain or are caused by the pain that are just as bad or in some cases worse than the pain itself. An example is sleep disruption. Chronic pain patients sleep absolutely terribly, and some of them say that I actually would rather you give me a good night's sleep than take away the pain. The sleep problem actually becomes worse than the pain problem.
Yeah.
And there's some other examples as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back to what we've always done and let me ask you a question about this, Jeffrey. Excuse me. So what about medication? Where are we? Are we learning anything new, anything promising out there?
Well, so the first thing that people should be reminded of is that, you know, the mainstay medications we have for pain are very, very old. They're thousands of years old. Ultimately, it's willow bark and poppy juice still. Now, we've made the willow bark and poppy juice a lot gentler on your stomach than it used to be. You know, we've cut down on the side effects a little bit. And we've given them sort of better properties in terms of when they come on and how long they last. But ultimately, at the end of the day, this is nothing new. There are a few new treatments, and I'm talking pharmacology now.
Yeah.
So there are new pills that are out for chronic pain, things like amitriptyline and pregabalin. And these are largely sort of accidental discoveries. These were drugs mm-hmm. that were used for other things, found to be good or not so good at treating those other things, and just sort of accidentally clinicians noticed that they were pretty good for pain in some cases. The question is, have we come up with anything new that was actually designed rationally, that, you know, followed the science and got approved? And there's very, very little of that out there. The only clear example I can think of is a drug called Prialt, which is from a cone toxin. And, of course, that can only be given spinally, and it's only for late-stage cancer patients, and so it's not really a panacea. So I would think one would be forgiven by concluding that we haven't done a very good job up to now. Now, that being said, there are now, as always, a number of things in development that look very promising and, you know, might be out fairly soon. And so things could turn around at any time.
Well,
now we're in a very dry period.
Yeah, all right. And I want to see if we can get another caller on. We've got Matt, who's been waiting patiently almost the whole show to get on. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing? This is Matt Purington, pain survivor and staff therapist at the Council for Relationships.
Yes.
And I completely agree that there aren't that many medical options nowadays, and that's why therapy is so important. And I use mindfulness, hypnosis, and systems-based therapy to give people as many tools in their toolbox as possible to help them cope with the various issues of chronic pain. And so I think what your guests have been saying about the technique, that they're right on, and I found it effective with clients with many different types of pain, as well as helping endurance athletes reduce their time by changing their relationship with their pain.
That's great, and I'm so glad it's helping you, Matt. Thanks so much for your call. Take care. Matt talked about what he does. You know, I've been practicing mindfulness for many years, and once I spoke with my neurologist who told me what was happening with my nerve endings, I just realized that it wasn't my pain, it wasn't Dan's pain, it was my body, my arms that were suffering. It wasn't me. And I just, you know, I changed figure and ground. When my arms are in pain, I just get quiet and I feel great compassion for my arms that are suffering. I mean, those poor things don't know what's going on. They're just suffering. It's not me. My ego gets quiet. My heart opens.
I love that. And I also think what you said is really important from another perspective, which is, it sounds like you're cultivating the sense that who you are is much bigger
right.
than your pain.
Right.
That your life is much larger than the experience of discomfort in your arms. And being able to broaden the scope of your attention like that, so that you can pull in more aspects of yourself and more aspects of your life, that process has also been shown to be quite therapeutic.
So that's go on.
I was just going to say, so that's one of the other components of mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement that I think is really important, and that is a component called savoring, which is teaching people to mindfully focus their attention on pleasant or positive experiences in their lives, naturally healthy experiences. For example, enjoying the beauty of a sunset and really focusing your attention in that moment and being there with the experience
and savoring whatever positive emotions come from that experience.
Or simply savoring a good conversation with two really, really smart guys and being able to share the information with hopefully 100,000 listeners.
That's right. That's right. Enjoying that. This is not inconsequential. In fact, it's totally consequential, even on a neurobiological level, because pain and the experience of reward, pain and pleasure, obviously, I mean, classically, they've been viewed as opposites, and in the brain, they serve some opposing effects as well. So there's evidence out there that suggests, this is from experimental laboratory studies, that suggests that if you can induce a positive mood in someone, you can induce a state of positive emotion in someone, that this dampens the pain experience.
Well, there,
and so teaching people.
There you go. Unfortunately, we are out of time, and I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Jeffrey Mogul and Eric Garland joined us to talk about chronic pain. Gentlemen, thank you. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to talk about empathy, how bearing witness to others' suffering can change our own stories and how we experience ourselves. Listen, a big announcement. Next Monday, my new book will be released, The Wisdom We're Born With. Get it or pre-order it now. The Wisdom We're Born With, Reawakening Faith in Ourselves. To download our podcast, we're at whyy.org/voices. You can follow us at Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam. Reach me at drdangottlieb.com. It's a new and exciting web page, so I invite you to get involved in the discussion. The engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Al, thank you very much. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer par excellence. Gita Simons is our producer, directed today's show, and did pretty much everything today. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.